blasted away as before, like incessant thunders, and again without much effect. If anyone among the American command saw the return of the two enemy ships from upriver as a sign of trouble, there is no record of it. The day after, August 19th, Washington had a number of old ships sunk at the mouth of the East River, between the Battery and Governor's Island, in the hope that they would stop the British fleet from any attempt at getting between New York and Brooklyn. Captain William Tudor, the judge advocate, described the whole army as impatient for action. Spade and pick had been so well employed, wrote Billy Tudor, that there was scarce a spot left undefended. From the advantage we now possess, I think General Howe must be repulsed whenever he attacks. But should he be able to carry the island, it must be with so prodigious a loss that victory will be ruined. At the least, in other words, it would be Bunker Hill all over again. On August 20th, Washington learned that Nathanael Greene, upon whom he counted more than anyone, had taken a turn for the worse. Knox, in letters to his wife, reported that poor General Greene was dangerously ill, sick nearly to death. Left no choice, Washington relieved Greene of command, and the stricken general was moved from Brooklyn Heights across the river to the airy safety of a house several miles above New York. In Greene's place, Washington put the headstrong John Sullivan, who had recently returned from Canada and who had nothing of Greene's ability or judgment. Further, Sullivan was, in Greene's expression, a complete stranger to the ground on Long Island. Writing to John Hancock earlier, Washington had offered a candid appraisal of Sullivan as spirited and zealously attached to the cause, but also a man touched with a tincture of vanity and too great a desire of being popular. Then, generously and realistically, Washington conceded that everyone in command of the army suffered from a greater, more serious failing, himself included. His wants, Washington said of Sullivan, are common to us all, the want of experience to move upon a large scale. At some point in the course of Wednesday, August 21st, Washington scratched off a quick note to John Hancock to say only that he had nothing special to communicate. That same day, at a country estate near Elizabethtown, New Jersey, General William Livingston, a former member of Congress and newly in command of the New Jersey militia, wrote in utmost haste to Washington that a spy he had sent to Staten Island had just returned to report that the British were about to attack, both on Long Island and up the Hudson, and that the attack could come any hour, this night at farthest. The reply from Washington, written in Joseph Reed's hand, said, "We have made no discovery of any movement here of any consequence." Chapter 5. Field of Battle. Remember, officers and soldiers, that you are free men fighting for the blessings of liberty. General George Washington. On the night of August 21st, 1776, a terrifying storm broke over New York, a storm as vicious as any in living memory, and for those who saw omens in such unleashed fury from the elements, those familiar with the writings of the Roman historian Livy say, or the plays of Shakespeare, of whom there were many, a night so violent seemed filled with portent. Chroniclers Philip Fithian, Ambrose Searle, and Pastor Ewald Schukirk called it a storm like a hurricane, a most terrible storm, the most vehement I ever saw, an uncommon awful scene. A Connecticut officer on Brooklyn Heights, Major Abner Benedict, would describe how at 7 o'clock a monstrous thundercloud rose in the west, looming higher and higher. It was surcharged with electricity, for the lightning was constantly searching it from limit to limit, he wrote. It began to rain, then followed a crash louder than 1,000 cannon. In a few minutes, the entire heavens became black as ink, and from horizon to horizon, the whole Empyrean was ablaze with lightning. The thunder did not follow in successive peals, but in one continuous crash. The storm raged for 3 hours, yet strangely the cloud appeared to stand still and swing round and round over the city. The lightning fell in masses and sheets of fire to the earth, and seemed to strike incessantly and on every side. Houses burst into flame. 10 soldiers camped by the East River below Fort Sterling were killed in a single flash. In New York, a soldier hurrying through the streets was struck deaf, blind, and dumb. In another part of town, 3 officers were killed by a single thunderbolt. A later report described how the tips of their swords and coins in their pockets had been melted, their bodies turned as black as if roasted. To Major Benedict, the roar and bloodshed of battle were something to be expected, but there seems hidden meaning, some secret purpose, when the bolt is launched by an invisible arm and from the mysterious depth of space. He could not account for the cloud remaining stationary for so long unless he speculated the vast amount of arms collected in and about the city held it by attraction and drew from it such a fearful amount of electricity. Before dawn the following day, Thursday, August 22nd, the sky was clear and cloudless, as if nothing unusual had happened. And with a fresh morning breeze and roll of drums, the long-awaited British invasion of Long Island got underway. The frigates Phoenix, with Lord Howe aboard, Rose and Greyhound, and 2 bomb catches, the Carcass and the Thunder, vessels equipped for shore bombardment, swung loose from their moorings and stood down the narrows to take their positions to cover the landing. Then, at approximately 5 o'clock, with day beginning to break, an advance corps, 4,000 of the King's elite troops, led by Generals Clinton and Cornwallis, pushed off. The men packed aboard scores of flatboats, these built during the time on Staten Island, with British sailors at the oars. Slowly but steadily, in glorious early sunshine, the invasion force proceeded across 3 miles of water, until at precisely 8 o'clock, at the flash of a signal gun from the Phoenix, all 4,000 troops went ashore on the long, flat, empty beach at Gravesend Bay. Everything had been carefully prepared, every move of the Army and Navy carefully coordinated. The landing was as smooth as if it had been rehearsed, and there was no opposition. The comparative few of Colonel Edward Hand's Pennsylvania riflemen, posted near the shore, had already withdrawn, driving off or killing cattle as they went, and burning wheat fields and farm buildings. The dense columns of smoke rising in the air could be seen in New York 8 miles away. As more troops followed, a naval spectacle of more than 90 vessels filled the narrows. Wave after wave of soldiers came on, their red coats and polished bayonets gleaming in the bright sunshine. 1 battalion of blue-coated Hessian grenadiers was ferried over standing in ranks, muskets in hand and in order of battle. By noon, a fully equipped army of 15,000 men and 40 pieces of artillery had landed and rapidly, smoothly assembled in perfect formation on the adjacent plain. And still more would follow, including the women who were with the army. Loyalists by the hundreds converged to welcome the invaders, many of them bringing long-hidden supplies of all kinds. The welcome was more effusive even than it had been on Staten Island. Meanwhile, Cornwallis and the advance guard pressed directly inland for 6 miles to establish a camp at the little Dutch village of Flatbush, near the wooded heights of Gowan. "It all made a picturesque scene," wrote Ambrose Searle. 15,000 troops upon a fine beach, then forming upon the adjacent plain. Ships and vessels with their sails spread open to dry, the sun shining clear upon them, the green hills and meadows after the rain. Add to all this the vast importance of the business, and the mind feels itself wonderfully engaged. British sailors who came ashore regaled themselves with fine apples which hung everywhere upon the trees in great abundance, Searle continued. It was really diverting to see sailors and apples tumbling from the trees together. But other aspects of the scene were anything but picturesque. A Hessian officer, Lieutenant Johann Heinrich von Bartleben, described burned-out houses, fields in ashes, roads lined with dead cattle, and old people looking with sadness at what appeared previously to have been a paradise standing in blooming abundance. Our regiment was camped amidst orchards of apple and pear trees. Here, too, the picture of destruction was to be seen on all sides. Almost everywhere there were chests of drawers, chairs, mirrors with gold-gilded frames, porcelain, and all sorts of items of the best and most expensive manufacture. The Hessian and British troops alike were astonished to find Americans blessed with such abundance, substantial farmhouses and fine furnishings. "In all the fields the finest fruit is to be found," Lieutenant von Bartleben wrote after taking a walk on his own, away from the path of destruction. "The peach and apple trees are especially numerous. The houses in part are made only of wood, and the furnishing in them are excellent. Comfort, beauty, and cleanliness are readily apparent." To many of the English, such affluence as they saw on Long Island was proof that America had indeed grown rich at the expense of Great Britain. In fact, the Americans of 1776 enjoyed a higher standard of living than any people in the world. Their material wealth was considerably less than it would become in time, still it was a great deal more than others had elsewhere. How people with so much, living on their own land, would ever choose to rebel against the ruler God had put over them, and thereby bring down such devastation upon themselves, was for the invaders incomprehensible. Word reached New York early in the day, but Washington was badly misinformed about the size of the enemy force that had come ashore. Told that there were 8,000 or 9,000, he quickly concluded the landing was the feint he had expected, and consequently he dispatched only 1,500 more troops across the East River to Brooklyn, bringing the total American strength on Long Island to something less than 6,000 men. The expectation of another larger strike by the British at New York or up the Hudson persisted. But then no one seemed to know what was going on. Lieutenant Jabez Fitch, whose Connecticut regiment was one of those ordered across the river, wrote in his diary of being marched forward at Brooklyn about a mile before being told to halt and wait for further orders. "While we are waiting, we hear many various reports concerning the enemy. Some say they are within 4 miles of us, others 2.5. Others say they have not advanced more than a mile from where they landed, which is near 10 miles. So, on the whole, we know not what to believe concerning them until we can see them." Colonel Moses Little, whose information was remarkably accurate, reported to his son that the enemy was within 3 miles, and said in the same letter, "I have thought fit to send you my will." Meanwhile, impressive numbers of Connecticut reinforcements had been arriving in New York. Only that day, 12 Connecticut regiments paraded in the city. "Almost one half of the Grand Army now consists of Connecticut troops," an officer boasted to his wife. The whole army, noted Joseph Reed, was in better spirits than he had ever seen. Not until the following day, August 23rd, did Washington confirm in his general orders that the British had come ashore on Long Island. Leaving no doubt about the seriousness of the moment for every man in the army, he appealed to their pride and patriotism and love of liberty. "The hour is fast approaching on which the honor and success of this army and the safety of our bleeding country depend. Remember, officers and soldiers, that you are free men fighting for the blessings of liberty, that slavery will be your portion and that of your posterity if you do not acquit yourselves like men. Nor should they forget that they faced an enemy who held them in contempt. Remember how your courage and spirit have been despised and traduced by your cruel invaders, though they have found by dear experience at Boston, Charleston, and other places what a few brave men contending in their own land and in the best of causes can do against base hirelings and mercenaries. They must be cool but determined." And again, as at Boston, he threatened instant death to any man who showed cowardice. To General Heath, in command of defenses to the north at King's Bridge, Washington sent a message saying he dared not weaken his forces in New York until he could be certain of the enemy's real intentions. "I have never been afraid of the force of the enemy," Heath answered. "I am more so of their arts. They must be well watched. They, like the Frenchmen, look one way and row the other." Joseph Reed, who was as close to Washington as anyone, expressed the same extreme concern. "The greatest vigilance is had to prevent a surprise," he wrote, "which we have to fear more than anything." Washington crossed to Brooklyn that afternoon to confer with General Sullivan. There had been some minor skirmishing only, he was told, and he returned to New York still more convinced that Howe had yet to commit his full force. "If the British had made no advance on New York with their fleet since landing on Long Island," he reported to Congress, "that could very well be because it was not in their power. For days the wind had either been head-on against them or too little when the tide served." Washington was beset by second thoughts. On August 24th, he reshuffled the command at Brooklyn, placing Israel Putnam over Sullivan, a move likely to unsettle the troops who had seen the stricken Greene replaced by Sullivan, and now Sullivan superseded by Putnam, all in a matter of days. Brave, popular old Putt might be the man to boost morale, but he had neither the experience nor the temperament to direct so large a force under such conditions, and was thus a poor choice, as Washington seems to have realized almost at once. Putnam and six battalions crossed to Brooklyn early the next day, a Sunday, causing a great stir. "Scarcely were religious services finished," wrote Abner Benedict, "when strains of martial music were heard from the ferry, and not long after column came winding up the heights toward the fort. The general was received with loud cheers, and his presence inspired universal confidence." The day's orders from Sullivan deplored the disorder and unsoldierly behavior displayed in the camps on the eve of battle. Yet soldiers were here, there, and everywhere, strolling about as if on holiday, some of them miles from the lines. "Carts and horses driving every way among the army," wrote Philip Fithian. "Men marching out and coming in, small arms and field pieces, continually firing, all in tumult." The contrast between such disorder and flagrant disregard for authority and the perfectly orchestrated landing by Howe's troops could not have been more pronounced. Arriving at Brooklyn, Washington was outraged by what he saw, and in a letter written later in the day, he lectured old Putt as he might the greenest lieutenant. "All irregularities must cease at once. The distinction between a well-regulated army and a mob is the good order and discipline of the first, and the licentious and disorderly behavior of the latter." Seeing things as they were, not as he would wish they were, was known to be one of Washington's salient strengths. And having witnessed firsthand the loose, disorderly, and unsoldierlike state of things among the troops at Brooklyn, and knowing how outnumbered they were by the enemy, he might have ordered an immediate withdrawal back to New York while there was still time. But he did not, nor is there any evidence that such a move was even considered. In New York all the while, more than half the army, including many of his best troops and best officers like Henry Knox, waited in anxious expectation of an attack there. "We expect the fleet up every tide if the wind serves," wrote a Connecticut colonel, William Douglas. That same Sunday, another 5,000 Hessians crossed the Narrows from Staten Island, bringing Howe's total forces on Long Island to 20,000. Washington returned again to Brooklyn early the following day, August 26th, to confer still again with his commanders and appraise the defenses and deployment of troops. Almost certainly he rode beyond Brooklyn to the heights of Gowan, where, from the ridgeline, he could have seen the white tents of the British spread across the plain at Flatlands. "General Washington, with a number of general officers, went down to view the motion of the enemy," reads one account. With his telescope, he could well have watched Howe's troops on their daily parade. The plan was for General Putnam to direct the entire defense from the fortifications on Brooklyn Heights. Generals Sullivan and Sterling and their troops were to be positioned well forward on the outwork of the wooded ridge, to cover the few main roads or passes through that long natural barrier. The Gowanus Road was on the far right, near the Narrows. The Flatbush Road was at the center, and thought to be the way the British would come. A third, the Bedford Road, was off to the left. All three were comparatively narrow cuts through the ridge, and thus easily defensible. The ridge of hills and woods was all that separated the two armies, but was seen by the Americans as the ideal forward line of defense, and so to their decided advantage. Joseph Reed, doubtless reflecting Washington's view, deemed it very important. The fight, when it came, would surely come there, in the woods, where, it was agreed, Americans fought best. Sterling was responsible for the Gowanus Road on the right, where about 500 troops were posted. Sullivan had command of both the Flatbush Road at the center, where 1,000 were deployed, and the Bedford Road on the left flank, where another 800 or so were positioned under Colonel Samuel Miles of Pennsylvania. In an absence of uniforms, every man was to put a sprig of green in his hat as identification. Washington's specific order to Putnam, who knew almost nothing about Long Island, having visited there only occasionally, was to position his best troops forward and at all hazards prevent the enemy's passing the wood and approaching the works. As things stood, a force of fewer than 3,000 soldiers, nearly all of whom had had no experience in battle, were expected to hold a ridge 4 miles long, while the rest, another 6,000, remained within the Brooklyn forts. In all, the outposts stretched 6 miles. The terrain was so rugged that units had trouble communicating, and so thickly wooded that in places men were blind to any movement beyond 100 feet. Had there been American cavalry to serve as eyes and ears, or had there been reliable intelligence, the defenders might have had a better chance. But there was neither. The Continental Army had no cavalry. Congress had not considered cavalry necessary, nor had Washington asked for any. And however adamant he was about the value of spies, as circumstances were, he had none. Nor in the 5 days since the British landing had anyone been stationed at a fourth, lesser-known pass on the far left, 3 miles east of the Bedford Road. The Jamaica Pass, as it was called, was narrower even than the others, and thus the easiest to defend. Yet nothing had been said in any of the orders of Sullivan or Putnam or Washington expressing concern about the Jamaica Pass or the need to post sufficient troops there. Having looked things over and conferred with his commanders, Washington approved the plan, including, presumably, a last-minute idea of having the Jamaica Pass patrolled by 5 young militia officers who had horses. Washington returned to New York that evening, convinced at last that the British would make their grand push against Brooklyn, or so he wrote to John Hancock. To General Heath he also wrote that by the present appearance of things, the enemy would make their capital impression on Long Island. But then, as if still unable to make up his mind, he cautioned yet again that it might all be only a feint to draw over our troops to that quarter in order to weaken us here. His army, he knew, was ill-prepared for what was to come. There was more sickness in the ranks than at any time before. Only a few of his officers had ever faced an enemy on the field of battle. He himself had never commanded an army in battle. His responsibilities, the never-ending load of business, weighed heavily. The same uncertainties that had vexed him in his first days of command at New York vexed him still. The enemy could not delay much longer. The time for warm weather campaigning, the season for action, was fast waning. Yet even now he consoled himself with the hope that he had a few more days before the enemy would strike. It had been a long, anxious day, and in the privacy of his quarters in the Mortier House, Washington turned his mind, turned for relief, it would seem, to thoughts of home. Alone at his desk, he wrote a long letter to his manager at Mount Vernon, Lund, Washington, filled with thoughts on the marketing of flour and specific directions concerning work on additions to the house. For much of the letter, it was as though he had nothing else on his mind. "I wish most ardently you would get the north end of the house covered in this fall. If you should be obliged to send all over Virginia, Maryland, and Pennsylvania for nails to do it with. Unless this is done, it will throw everything exceedingly backward, retard the design of planting trees, besides keeping the house in a disagreeable, littered situation. It is equally my wish to have the chimneys run up. In short, I would wish to have the whole closed in, if you were even to hire many workmen of different kinds to accomplish it." Of the war, he wrote that a few more days would likely bring matters to an issue one way or other. If he did not think the struggle just, nothing on earth could compensate for the loss of all my domestic happiness and requite me for the load of business which constantly presses upon and deprives me of every enjoyment. What he may have written to his wife Martha that night, or at any point in the course of events to come, is unknown, since she later destroyed all but three of his letters to her, and these survived only by accident. His sleep that night was to be abbreviated, yet the most he would have for days. General Henry Clinton, not an impressive man in looks or manner, had thus far in the war done little to show that appearances could be deceiving, and that he had, as he knew, marked intelligence and ability. For more than a year he had fared poorly in the service of his king. At Boston he and William Howe had been continuously at odds, and he had failed most grievously, in his mind, to convince Howe to seize Dorchester Heights before the rebels did. Sent off to South Carolina, he had failed in his mission there. An attack on Fort Sullivan at Charleston in June had been such a humiliating defeat for the British that the campaign had to be abandoned, and largely because Clinton had been too cautious. Then, returning to New York, he had seen all his arguments for an invasion up the Hudson rejected out of hand by Howe. Clinton knew his failings. He knew he could be difficult, inclined to speak too freely, that he was touchy, and that in discussion his excessive zeal often worked to his disadvantage. On paper, however, Henry Clinton could be bold and convincing. He had returned from Charleston, greatly changed in outlook. His defeat had convinced him that the war should be waged not to conquer territory, but to destroy the rebel army by outflanking it, whenever or wherever possible. If not by water, then on land. As a strategist, he knew well how to use a map. "Look at the map," he would proclaim. Soon after the landing at Gravesend, accompanied by another general, Sir William Erskine, and Lord Rawdon, Clinton had ridden off to reconnoiter the rebel defenses and the few passes through the wooded heights of Gowan. Told by Loyalist farmers of the little-used Jamaica Pass beyond the Bedford Road, and that it appeared to be unguarded, the three British officers continued on to find that what they had been told was true. Clinton immediately drew up a plan. This time, however, instead of going to Howe to make the case himself, he asked General Erskine to take what he had written to the headquarters at Flatlands. It read as follows: "The position which the rebels occupy in our front may be turned by a gorge about 6 miles from us, through a country in which cavalry may make the avant-garde. That, once possessed, gives us the island, and in a mile or two further we shall be on the communications with their works at Brooklyn. The corps which attempts to turn this flank must be in very great force, for reasons too obvious to require detailing. The attack should begin on the enemy's right by signal, and a share should be taken in it, even by the fleet, which, as the tide will then suit, may get under way and make every demonstration of forcing by the enemy's batteries in the East River, without, however, committing themselves. The efforts to be made by the army will be along the Dodon, at the points of Flatbush, New Utrecht, and so forth. These are the principal attacks, many other small ones to cooperate. They should all be vigorous, but not too obstinately persisted in, except that which is designed to turn the left of the rebels, which should be pushed as far as it will go. The moment this corps gets possession of the pass above Howard's House, Howard's Tavern, the rebels must quit directly or be ruined. I beg leave also to propose that this corps may begin to move at nightfall, so that everything may be ready at its ground by daybreak. Several days passed. Then on August 26, the same day Washington spent looking things over at Brooklyn, Clinton was sent for and told by Howe that the attack would be made entirely according to his plan and to be prepared to march that night. General Grant, with two brigades, was to make a spirited early morning diversion close to the Narrows, striking at the enemy's right. General Leopold Philip von Heister's Hessians, another 4,000 men, would move out from Flatbush to keep the Americans occupied at the center. In the meantime, the main body of the army would move under the cover of dark to be in position by daybreak. Clinton was to command the advance guard on the night march, General Howe following with the rest of the main force, numbering in all 10,000 men. If asked to describe the common soldiers of the King's army, the redcoats now falling in and dressing their ranks in the gathering dusk at Flatlands, most of the American soldiers who lay in wait for them would probably have said they were hardened, battle-scarred veterans, the sweepings of the London and Liverpool slums, debtors, drunks, common criminals and the like, who had been bullied and beaten into mindless obedience. It was the common American view. The truth was something else. That the rank-and-file British regular was far better trained, better disciplined, better equipped, and more regularly paid than his American counterpart was beyond question, as the commanders on both sides well appreciated. Further, the redcoats were in far better health overall. Proper sanitation was part of British Army life, and discipline in this regard was as strictly enforced as any aspect of the daily routine. Even after their long summer encampment on Staten Island, the British troops, as their officers noted repeatedly, were in excellent health, in striking contrast to the reports of rampant illness among the rebels. In an effort to explain why the provincials would in their own climate be so afflicted with putrid disorders, while His Majesty's troops, who were foreign to the climate, would enjoy perfect health, the London Chronicle said the difference was the great cleanliness of the regulars. Among the regular troops, every private soldier is obliged to put on a clean shirt twice, perhaps three times a week, according to the season and climate, and there are a certain number of officers appointed every day to see that each man washes his own linen, if he had not a woman to do it for him. While the dregs of society did indeed count among the king's troops, the great majority were young countrymen from rural England, Scotland, and Ireland. They were farmers, unskilled laborers, and tradesmen, blacksmiths, cordwainers, carpenters, bakers, hatters, locksmiths, and weavers, who had been recruited, not pressed into service, drawn by the promise of clothing, food, and steady if meager pay, along with a chance at adventure, perhaps even a touch of glory. In their rural or small-town origins, they were not greatly different from their American counterparts. The average British regular was in his late 20s, or about 5 years older than the average American soldier. But the average regular had served 5 or 6 years in the Army, or 5 or 6 times longer than the average volunteer under Washington. To the British rank and file, there was nothing novel about being a soldier. The harsh life was their way of life. They carried themselves like soldiers. They had rules, regulations, and traditions down pat. They were proud to serve in His Majesty's Army, proud of the uniform, and fiercely proud of and loyal to their regiments. On a day such as this, on the eve of battle, they would have given close attention to all the particulars of their arms and accoutrements, and each man to his own appearance. Most would be freshly shaved, and their uniforms made as presentable as possible. On the move, seen from a distance, they looked glorious in their red coats and crossbelts, marching rank on rank, their huge regimental battle flags flying at the front atop 10-foot poles. Seen up close, however, the red coats, waist-length in front, longer at the back, were often faded and out at the elbows. Cuffs were frayed, knees patched, stockings or marching gaiters often torn beyond mending, try as each man would to look the part. And with the pride in who and what they were went a very real contempt for, even hatred of, their American foes, whom they saw as cowards and traitors. But by no means were they all battle-scarred veterans. Some of the older soldiers and officers were veterans of the killing fields of Europe during the Seven Years' War, or the French and Indian War in America, or had survived the retreat from Concord or the Battle of Bunker Hill. The rest, the great majority of the British forces on Long Island, including the Germans, knew only the drill and routine of army life. For as long as the average soldier in Howe's ranks had been in service, it had been longer still, more than 10 years, since Britain had last waged war. For most of the redcoats, soldiers and young officers, like nearly all of the Americans, the battle to come was to be their first. By nightfall, everything was ready. At 9 came the order to move out. Clinton led a crack brigade of light infantry with fixed bayonets. Cornwallis followed with 8 reserve battalions and 14 pieces of artillery. They, in turn, were followed by Generals Howe and Percy with another 6 battalions, more artillery, and baggage wagons. The column of 10,000 stretched more than 2 miles. At the head of the advance guard rode 2 mounted officers, Captains William Glanville Evelyn and Oliver Delancey, Jr., and 3 Loyalist farmers who knew the way. The white tents at Flatlands were left standing, campfires burning, all to appear as though nothing were happening. The night was unseasonably cool. The long column moved with utmost silence and extremely slowly. An exhausted Scottish officer, who had had several sleepless nights on duty, described the march as one of the worst he had known, and endless. "We dragged on at the most tedious pace," wrote Sir James Murray, "halting every minute just long enough to drop asleep, and to be disturbed again in order to proceed 20 yards in the same manner." By agreeing to Clinton's plan, by committing a force of such numbers to a night march through unknown country, led like the blind by 3 local farmers who might or might not be all they professed, William Howe was putting his army at extreme risk. In the event of discovery or sudden surprise attack by the enemy, his stretched-out column could be chopped to pieces. If all went as planned, the maneuver would look like little more than a classic turning of the enemy's flank. But it took no great stretch of imagination to picture the unforeseen circumstances, the vagaries of chance that could play havoc. As it was, no one except the commanders knew the details of the plan. Not an officer or a man knew where they were going. The route was northeast along what was known as the King's Highway. Then, at the village of New Lots, the troops would swing north toward the heights of Gowan. The advance guard moved swiftly, at the same time sweeping up any local inhabitants who looked as though they might give the alarm. When the 3 Loyalist guides warned that the rebels could be waiting at Schoonmaker's Bridge, over a little salt creek that emptied into Jamaica Bay, the whole column halted, while skirmishers went ahead. But there was no one at the bridge, and the army continued on. Nor was there a sign of the rebels at Howard's Tavern, which stood a few hundred yards from the entrance to the Jamaica Pass. By then it was 2 in the morning. The tavern keeper and his 14-year-old son were rousted out of bed, closely questioned, and pressed into service as additional guides. The pass, as far as they knew, was unguarded. Captains Evelyn and Delancey and other mounted officers rode ahead into the pass, a winding, rocky road through a narrow gorge overhung by trees and little wider than a bridle path. It was only 10 minutes or so after leaving the tavern when the officers came up on 5 dark figures on horseback, the 5 Americans on patrol. When the Americans, supposing the British officers to be a party of their own troops, fell in with them, all 5 were immediately captured, without a shot fired or scarcely a sound. The prisoners were taken to General Clinton, who succeeded in learning from them that they alone were patrolling the pass, and that, indeed, the pass was entirely unguarded. When Clinton pressed harder, demanding to know how many rebel troops were at Brooklyn, one of the Americans, Lieutenant Edward Dunscombe, a 22-year-old graduate of King's College, told Clinton indignantly that under different circumstances he would never insult them in such a manner. called an impudent rebel and threatened with hanging. Dunscombe said that General Washington would respond in kind and hang man for man. But Dunscombe's courage made little difference. He and the other prisoners were taken away, and Clinton and the advance guard moved on. By first light, they were through the gorge and at the Bedford Road on the other side of the ridge. The men were told to lie down in the tall grass by the road and get some rest. For the main body of the army, the march through the pass took nearly 2 hours. Wherever a tree had to be cleared to make way for the artillery and wagons, it had to be done with saws instead of axes in order to maintain all possible silence. By the time Howe and the army reached the Bedford Road, the sun was up. At exactly 9 o'clock, with the blasts of 2 heavy cannon, the prearranged signal for the Hessians at the center and General Grant on the American right to commence their assaults, Howe's army pushed on down the road toward the village of Bedford and to Brooklyn beyond. Years later, Henry Clinton would remember Howe being extremely apprehensive. "The commander-in-chief seemed to have some suspicion the enemy would attack us on our march. But I was persuaded that, as they had neglected to oppose us at the gorge, the affair was over." Good fortune had accompanied them through the night. Nothing had gone amiss. The troops had marched 9 miles in pitch darkness, through unfamiliar country, and in perfect order. Everything was on schedule, and the day, like the day they first came ashore on Long Island, was perfectly beautiful. It was 3 in the morning when General Putnam was awakened by one of the guards at the Brooklyn headquarters and told the enemy was attacking on the right near the Narrows at the Gowanus Road. The British commander Grant had decided to occupy the attention of the Americans on that part of the line ahead of schedule. 300 British troops had stormed into the Gowanus Pass with a roar of musket fire, and the Americans on guard, Green Militia, fled as fast as they could. Putnam rushed to Lord Stirling's camp outside the Brooklyn lines to order Stirling to move to meet the enemy and repulse them, little knowing how many of the enemy there were. Alarm guns sounded, drums rolled as troops fell out of the forts. General Samuel Parsons, who with Stirling shared responsibility for defenses on the Gowanus Road, and who, like Putnam, had been resting at the Brooklyn headquarters, mounted his horse and galloped off to arrive first on the scene. Until the year before, Parsons had been a small-town Connecticut lawyer. "I found by fair daylight," Parsons wrote, "the enemy were through the wood and descending the hill on the north side, on which, with 20 of my fugitive guard being all I could collect, I took post on a height in their front at about 0.5 mile's distance, which halted their column and gave time for Lord Stirling with his forces to come up." Stirling's forces numbered 1,600 men and included Colonel Huntington's Connecticut Regiment, in which Jabez Fitch served, and Colonel Samuel Attlee's Pennsylvania Battalion, in addition to Smallwood's Marylanders and Haslett's colorful Delaware Battalion, which were thought to be the 2 best units in the Army. But as it happened, both their commanders, James Smallwood and John Haslett, were absent on court-martial duty in New York. "A little before day, as we marched towards the enemy 2 miles from our camp, we saw them," wrote a 19-year-old lieutenant with the Delaware troops, Enoch Anderson. "In what seemed no time, they were in the middle of what Moses Little called a smart engagement. The redcoat regiments came on in regular order, colors flying, field artillery out in front. Stirling drew up his lines and, in the words of another American soldier, offered them battle in true English taste. The British marched to within 200 yards, then opened fire with cannon and muskets, now and then taking off a head," as the same soldier wrote. "Our men stood it amazingly well. Not even one of them showed a disposition to shrink. Their orders were to hold their fire until the enemy came within 50 yards. But when they perceived we stood their fire so cool and so resolutely, they declined to come any nearer, although treble our number. We gave them a fair fire. Every man leveled well," young Enoch Anderson recounted. "I saw one man tumble from his horse. Never did I take better aim at a bird. Yet I know not that I killed any or touched any. The fire was returned, and they killed two of our men dead, none wounded. It became proper for us to retreat, and we retreated about 400 yards and were joined by Captain Attlee's regiment. Twice within an hour, the British assaulted Parsons' troops on their high ground, and twice the American lines held. Sterling's men were under steady cannon bombardment, but American cannon answered in kind, and in the roar and smoke the American troops never flinched. In this its first hours of battle with the enemy on an open field, the Continental Army fought valiantly, believing they were holding their own against British regulars. Addressing the troops, Sterling reminded them that it was General Grant who had boasted that with 5,000 men he could conquer all of America. But as they could not know, Grant was pressing his advantage only so much, holding back according to plan. "We had a skirmishing and a cannonade for some hours, which drew their whole attention," Grant would later say. At the center, where Hessian artillery had been bombarding Sullivan's lines along the ridges since early morning, General von Heister's brigades could be seen drawn up on the plain to the south, but showed no sign of moving. Three Hessian brigades stood waiting in a line nearly a mile long. Sullivan had ridden out from Brooklyn to take command at the Flatbush Pass. Seeing that the Hessians were not moving and that Sterling was in trouble on the right, he sent some of his regiments to help. Until 9 o'clock, the battle seemed to be unfolding about as the Americans had expected, with the enemy attacking, or poised to attack, head-on. But at 9 came the crash of Howe's signal guns, and suddenly Sullivan realized that a whole British army was coming at him from behind, and that he was surrounded. On the plain beyond the ridge, General von Heister gave the order, and with drums rolling, the Hessians were in motion. Leaving his advance guard posted along the ridge to do what they could to hold off the Hessians, Sullivan pulled back his main force and swung around to face the oncoming British ranks. And though vastly outnumbered, the Americans returned the British fire with murderous effect. Officers on both sides feared their men would be cut to pieces, and officers and soldiers on both sides often had no idea what was happening. Nor was it the Americans only who, when faced with annihilation, ran for their lives. A British light infantry officer who led 30 of Clinton's advance guard into the very thick of several hundred American riflemen saw a third of his men go down in the most ferocious exchange of fire he had ever known. When he and a half dozen redcoats broke for the woods, more rebels sprang up out of nowhere. The fire seemed to come from every direction. I called to my men to run to the first wall they could find, and we all set off, some into short bushes, others straight across a field. And in running across the field, we were exposed to the fire of 300 men. We had literally run out in the midst of them, and they calling to me to surrender. I stopped twice to look behind me, and saw the riflemen so thick, and not one of my own men. I made for the wall as hard as I could drive, and they peppering at me. At last I gained the wall and threw myself headlong. In the turmoil and confusion, Sullivan struggled to hold control and keep his men from panicking. Their situation was desperate. Retreat was the only alternative. And in stages of fight and flight, he led them as rapidly as possible in the direction of the Brooklyn lines. Those left to hold the ridge had by now been overrun by the Hessians. Green-coated Jaegers, literally huntsmen, and the blue-coated grenadiers with their 17-inch bayonets had moved up through the steep woods of the ridge, the terrible hills, as swiftly and expertly as any Virginia rifleman. So suddenly did they appear that the Americans had time to get off only a shot or two, or none at all. Some fought back, wielding their muskets and rifles like clubs before being run through with bayonets. Some pleaded for mercy. Their fear of the Hessian troops was indescribable, wrote General von Heister. At the very sight of a blue coat, he said, they surrendered immediately and begged on their knees for their lives. Those who could get away fled back down through the trees and out into the open, only to run headlong into a hail of British fire. At the same time, the whole left side of the American line collapsed. Thousands of men were on the run. Hundreds were captured. Sullivan held back in an effort to see as many as possible to safety, and amazingly, most of the men succeeded in reaching the Brooklyn lines. Sullivan, however, was captured. An American soldier named Lewis Morris, who himself barely escaped, wrote of Sullivan in a letter home. "The last I heard of him, he was in a cornfield close by our lines, with a pistol in each hand, and the enemy had formed a line each side of him, and he was going directly between them. I like to have been taken prisoner myself." The precise time of Washington's arrival on the scene at Brooklyn was not recorded, but it is believed he crossed over from New York at about 9 o'clock, or just as Howe's signal gun sounded. Like General Putnam, Washington, too, had been awakened in the middle of the night with word of Grant's early assault, and at daybreak, still apprehensive of a second larger attack on New York, Washington had watched with increasing anxiety as 5 enemy warships, Roebuck, Asia, Renown, Preston, and Repulse, started for the East River with a favorable wind and tide. It was what he had most feared. Then, miraculously, the wind had veered off to the north. The ships, after tacking to and fro, trying to gain headway, at last gave up. Only the Roebuck could fetch high enough to threaten the battery at Red Hook with a few random shots. So Long Island it was to be, Washington saw. He immediately ordered more troops to Brooklyn and wasted no time having himself rowed across the river, Joseph Reed at his side. Private Joseph Martin, one of those in the units ordered to march to the Brooklyn Ferry, remembered the cheers of the soldiers as they embarked, and the answering cheers of the spectators who thronged the wharves to watch the excitement. "They all wished us good luck, apparently." For his own part, Private Martin could think only of the horrors of war in all their hideousness. On reaching the Brooklyn side, he saw, as he never had, the blood and suffering of wounded men. "What were the feelings of most or all of the young soldiers at this time, I know not," he would remember, "but I know what were mine. I saw a lieutenant who ran around among the men of his company, sniveling and blubbering, praying each one if he had aught against him, or if he had injured any one, that they would forgive him, declaring at the same time that he, from his heart, forgave them if they had offended him. Had he been at the gallows with a halter about his neck, he could not have shown more fear or penitence. 'A fine soldier you are,' I thought, 'a fine officer, an exemplary man for young soldiers. I would have suffered anything short of death rather than have made such an exhibition of myself.'" Accounts of Washington's activities as the battle raged are few and somewhat conflicting. He would be remembered out in plain view on horseback, watching the clash of armies through a telescope. Stories would be told of him riding among the troops, exhorting them to quit yourselves like men, like soldiers, or saying, "I will fight so long as I have a leg or an arm." One soldier later described him walking the lines to rally the men. Possibly he did all of that. More likely, his place was a vantage point on Brooklyn Heights, and in any case what was happening was out of his hands. By 10 o'clock his army had been hopelessly outflanked. The British were within 2 miles of the Brooklyn lines. Defeated men by the hundreds were streaming in from the battlefield, many blood-spattered and wounded, all exhausted. Officers were missing. Washington was facing disaster, and could do nothing but sit astride his horse and watch. Only on the right did the uproar of cannon and musket fire continue, as the indomitable Sterling and his men fought on against Grant's far greater force, still in the belief that they were holding the line. Colonel Samuel Attlee, who commanded the Pennsylvanians, would remember actually thinking the British were going down to defeat. "For the batteries began to play and mowed them down like grass when they retreated, and our army cried out, 'The day is our own.'" But Grant kept holding back, and in the interval his division of 5,000 had been reinforced by 2,000 Marines from the British ships offshore and two companies of New York loyalists recruited that spring and summer by Governor Tryon. Sterling had been ordered by Putnam to repulse the enemy, and for lack of orders to the contrary, he and his men had held on for nearly 4 hours. With great pride and no exaggeration, Colonel John Haslett would describe how his Delawares stood with determined countenance in close array, their colors flying, the enemy's artillery playing on them all the while, and the enemy, though six times their number, not daring to attack. But they had stayed too long. At 11 o'clock, Grant's redcoats hit hard at the center of Sterling's line, as thousands of Hessians struck from the woods to the left. When Sterling at last pulled back, it was too late. More British were coming at him from the rear, on the Gowanus Road, the line of retreat he had been counting on. A full British division led by Cornwallis now stood between him and Brooklyn. The only escape route still open, he saw, was in the direction of Gowanus Bay, now on his left, across a tidal marsh and creek, which at high tide was about 80 yards wide, and the tide was coming in rapidly. Sterling ordered his men to make the best of their way through the marsh and across the creek. Then he and Major Mordecai Gist and no more than 250 Marylanders attacked Cornwallis in a headlong, valiant effort to cover the retreat of the others and perhaps even break through the redcoats who had established their line on the Gowanus Road beside a stone farmhouse. The fighting was the most savage of the day. Driven back by a blaze of deadly fire, Sterling's men rallied and struck again 5 times. Sterling himself fought like a wolf. The Marylanders, who until that morning had never faced an enemy, fought no less tenaciously than their commander. Washington, watching from a Brooklyn hill, is said to have cried out as he saw the Marylanders cut down time after time, "Good God, what brave fellows I must this day lose." Giving up at last, Sterling ordered the men to scatter and try to get back to the Brooklyn lines any way they could. Of those trying to escape through the marshes, many bogged down in the mud and could get nowhere. Men unable to swim struggled pitifully in the swift tide of the creek and under a hail of musket fire. Some officers swam their horses across. A few of the men who could not swim held back and were captured. An 18-year-old 6-month volunteer with the Pennsylvania unit, Private Michael Graham, who started the day posted with 8 others on the ridge at the center of the American lines, had been ordered to retreat. With men running in almost every direction, he found himself mixed in with Sterling's troops in their desperate flight. "It is impossible for me to describe the confusion and horror. I entered a swamp or marsh, through which a great many of our men were retreating. Some of them were mired and crying to their fellows for God's sake to help them out. But every man was intent on his own safety. At the side of the marsh there was a pond which I took to be a mill pond. Numbers as they came to this pond jumped in, and some were drowned. I got safely into camp. Out of the 8 men that were taken from the company to which I belonged the day before the battle on guard, I only escaped. The others were killed or taken prisoners. At the time, I could not account for how it was that our troops were so completely surrounded." Joseph Hodgkins, as he later recounted for his wife, had run pell-mell into the marshes while being fired on the whole way. He hardly knew who was killed or drowned or taken prisoner. Lord Sterling, finding himself hopelessly surrounded and determined not to surrender his sword to the British, broke through their fire to a Hessian regiment and gave himself up to General von Heister. By noon or shortly thereafter, the rout was over, the day lost for the Americans. British troops, having advanced so far so rapidly, wanted to keep going and carry the attack straight to the Brooklyn Works. Numbers of British officers, too, felt it was no time to stop. But Howe ordered a halt. In his original plan, General Clinton had said the principal attacks, while vigorous, should not be pushed too far. The only exception was the all-important flanking attack, which, he said, should be pushed as far as it will go. Clinton would later write of Howe's decision to halt, I had at the moment but little inclination to check the ardor of our troops when I saw the enemy flying in such a panic before them. Howe himself, recalling the mood of the men, would later write that it required repeated orders to prevail on them to